Penguin Audio presents Collapse by Jared Diamond, read by Christopher Murney. A few summers ago, I visited two dairy farms, Hull's Farm and Garter Farm, which, despite being located thousands of miles apart, were still remarkably similar in their strengths and vulnerabilities. Both were by far the largest, most prosperous, most technologically advanced farms in their respective districts. In particular, each was centered around a state-of-the-art barn for sheltering and milking cows. Both farms let their cows graze outdoors in lush pastures during the summer, produce their own hay for feeding the cows through the winter, and increase their production of hay by irrigating their fields. The two farms were similar in area, a few square miles, and in barn size, Hull's barn holding somewhat more cows than Garter barn, 200 versus 165 cows respectively. Both farms were located in gorgeous natural settings that attract tourists from afar, with backdrops of high snow-capped mountains drained by streams teeming with fish. Those were the shared strengths of the two farms. As for their shared vulnerabilities, both lay in districts economically marginal for dairying, because their high northern latitudes meant a short summer growing season in which to produce pasture grass and hay. Because the climate was suboptimal compared to dairy farms at lower latitudes, both farms were susceptible to being harmed by climate change. Both districts lay far from population centers to which they could market their products, so that transportation costs and hazards placed them at a competitive disadvantage compared to more centrally located districts. The economies of both farms were hostage to forces beyond their owners' control, such as the changing affluence and tastes of their customers and neighbors. On a larger scale, the economies of the countries in which both farms lay rose and fell with the waxing and waning of threats from distant enemy societies. The biggest difference between Hull's Farm and Garter Farm is in their current status. Hull's Farm, a family enterprise in the Bitterroot Valley of Montana, is currently prospering. But Garter Farm, the former manor farm of the Norse Bishop of southwestern Greenland, was abandoned over 500 years ago. Greenland Norse society collapsed completely. Its thousands of inhabitants starved to death, were killed in civil unrest, or in war against an enemy, or emigrated, until nobody remained alive. Yet when Garter Farm and Norse Greenland were at their peak, their decline seemed as inconceivable as does the decline of Hull's Farm and the U.S. today. In drawing these parallels between Hull's and Garter Farms, I'm not claiming that Hull's Farm and American society are doomed to decline. Instead, my trips to Hull's and Garter Farms during the same summer vividly brought home to me the conclusion that even the richest, technologically most advanced societies today face growing environmental and economic problems that should not be underestimated. Many of our problems are broadly similar to those that undermine Garter Farm and Norse Greenland, and that many other past societies also struggle to solve. Norse Greenland is just one of many past societies that collapsed or vanished. By collapse, I mean a drastic decrease in human population size and/or political, economic, social complexity over a considerable area for an extended time. How could a society that was once mighty end up collapsing? What were the fates of its individual citizens? Did they move away, or did they die there in some unpleasant way? Lurking behind this romantic mystery is the nagging thought, might such a fate eventually befall our own wealthy society? Will tourists someday stare mystified at the rusting hulks of New York skyscrapers, much as we stare today at the jungle-overgrown ruins of Maya cities? It has long been suspected that many of those mysterious abandonments were at least partly triggered by ecological problems, people inadvertently destroying the environmental resources on which their societies depended. This suspicion has been confirmed by discoveries made in recent decades by archaeologists, climatologists, historians, paleontologists, and palynologists, pollen scientists. The processes through which past societies have undermined themselves by damaging their environments fall into eight categories, whose relative importance differs from case to case. Deforestation and habitat destruction, soil problems, water management problems, overhunting, overfishing, effects of introduced species on native species, human population growth, and increased per capita impact of people. The risk of such collapses today is now a matter of increasing concern. Indeed, collapses have already materialized for Somalia, Rwanda, and some other third world countries. The environmental problems facing us today include the same 8 that undermine past societies, plus 4 new ones: human-caused climate change, buildup of toxic chemicals in the environment, energy shortages, and full human utilization of the Earth's photosynthetic capacity. Most of these 12 threats will become globally critical within the next few decades. Either we solve the problems by then, or the problems will undermine not just Somalia, but also first world societies. Much more likely than a doomsday scenario involving human extinction or an apocalyptic collapse of industrial civilization would be a future of significantly lower living standards, chronically higher risks, and the undermining of what we now consider some of our key values. If this reasoning is correct, then our efforts today will determine the state of the world in which the current generation of children and young adults lives out their middle and late years. But the seriousness of these current environmental problems is vigorously debated. Are the risks greatly exaggerated, or are they underestimated? Does it stand to reason that today's human population of almost 7 billion, with our potent modern technology, is causing our environment to crumble globally at a much more rapid rate than a mere few million people with stone and wooden tools already made it crumble locally in the past? Will modern technology solve our problems, or is it creating new problems faster than it solves old ones? Isn't the rate of human population growth declining such that we're already on course for the world's population to level off at some manageable number of people? These questions illustrate why those famous collapses of past civilizations have taken on more meaning than just that of a romantic mystery. Perhaps there are some practical lessons that we could learn. What exactly were the processes by which past societies committed ecocide? Why did some past societies fail to see the messes that they were getting into? Which were the solutions that succeeded in the past? If we could answer these questions, we might be able to identify which societies are now most at risk, and what measures could best help them, without waiting for more Somalia-like collapses. Efforts to understand past collapses have had to confront one major controversy: resistance to the idea that past peoples did things that contributed to their own decline. Not surprisingly, native Hawaiians and Maoris don't like paleontologists telling them that their ancestors exterminated half of the bird species on Hawaii and New Zealand. The supposed discoveries by paleontologists and archaeologists sound to some listeners like just one more racist pretext advanced by whites for dispossessing indigenous peoples. Not only indigenous peoples, but also some anthropologists and archaeologists who study them and identify with them view the recent supposed discoveries as racist lies. Some of them instead insist that past indigenous peoples were gentle and ecologically wise stewards of their environments, innocently lived in a virtual Garden of Eden, and could never have done all those bad things. Only those evil modern first world inhabitants are ignorant of nature, don't respect the environment, and destroy it. In fact, past peoples were neither ignorant bad managers nor conscientious environmentalists. They were people like us, facing problems broadly similar to those that we now face. Of course, it's not true that all societies are doomed to collapse because of environmental damage. In the past, some societies did while others didn't. The real question is what distinguished those that collapsed from those that didn't. I don't know of any case in which a society's collapse can be attributed solely to environmental damage. There are always other contributing factors. When I began to plan this book, I didn't appreciate those complications, and I naively thought that the book would just be about environmental damage. Eventually, I arrived at a 5-point framework of possible contributing factors that I now consider in trying to understand any putative environmental collapse. 4 of those sets of factors, environmental damage, climate change, hostile neighbors, and friendly trade partners, may or may not prove significant for a particular society. The fifth set of factors, the society's responses to its environmental problems, always prove significant. A society's responses depend on its political, economic, and social institutions, and on its cultural values. Those institutions and values affect whether the society solves or even tries to solve its problems. In this book, we shall consider this 5-point framework for each past society whose collapse or persistence is discussed. I was born in Boston and had never been west of the Mississippi until the age of 15, when my parents took me to spend a few weeks of the summer in Montana, in the Big Hole Basin just south of the Bitterroot Valley. I was immediately overwhelmed by the Big Hole setting, a broad, flat valley floor covered with meadows and meandering creeks, but surrounded by a wall of seasonally snow-covered mountains rising abruptly on every horizon. 3 years later, while I was a student in college, I came back for the summer with two college friends and my sister, and we worked on the hay harvest, I driving a scatter rake, my sister a buck rake, and my two friends stacking hay. After that summer in 1956, it was a long time before I returned to Montana. Finally, in 1998, I happened to receive an invitation from a private, non-profit foundation called the Teller Wildlife Refuge in the Bitterroot Valley. I reconnected to Montana. Since then, my wife and sons and I have been visiting Montana every year, drawn to it ultimately by the unforgettable beauty of its big sky. Montana in general and the Bitterroot Valley in the Southwest are a land of paradoxes. Among the lower 48 states, Montana is the third largest in area, yet the sixth smallest in population. Today, the Bitterroot Valley looks lush, belying its original natural vegetation of sagebrush. Ravalli County, in which the valley is located, is so beautiful and attracts so many immigrants from elsewhere in the U.S. that it is one of our nation's fastest-growing counties. Yet 70% of its own high school graduates leave the valley, and most of those leave Montana. Some of the people recently establishing homes in the valley are extremely wealthy, but Ravalli County is nevertheless one of the poorest counties in the state of Montana, which in turn is nearly the poorest state in the U.S. Many of the county's residents find that they have to hold two or three jobs, even to earn an income at U.S. poverty levels. We associate Montana with natural beauty. Indeed, environmentally, Montana is perhaps the least damaged of the lower 48 states. Nevertheless, the Bitterroot Valley presents a microcosm of the environmental problems plaguing the rest of the United States. If even Montana has environmental and population problems, it becomes easier to understand how much more serious those problems are elsewhere in the U.S. The same environmental disadvantages that penalize food production throughout the American intermontane West also limit Montana's suitability for growing crops and raising livestock. They are relatively low rainfall, resulting in low rates of plant growth, high latitude and high altitude, resulting in a short growing season, and distance from markets. What those disadvantages mean is that anything grown in Montana can be grown more cheaply and with higher productivity elsewhere in North America. Hence, Montana's history consists of attempts to answer the fundamental question, how to make a living in this beautiful but agriculturally non-competitive land. Human occupation of Montana falls into several economic phases. The first phase was of Native Americans, who arrived at least 13,000 years ago. In contrast to the agricultural societies that they developed in eastern and southern North America, Montana's Native Americans were hunter-gatherers. The first recorded Europeans to visit were the members of the Lewis and Clark expedition of 1804 to 1806. They were followed by Montana's second economic phase, involving the mountain men, fur trappers and traders coming down from Canada and also from the U.S. The next phase began in the 1860s and was based on three foundations of Montana's economy that have continued until the present: mining, logging, and food production. The influx of miners to Montana's big copper mine at Butte stimulated other sectors of the economy to meet the needs of that internal market within the state. Timber was taken out of the nearby Bitterroot Valley to provide power for the mines, to construct houses, and to shore up the mine shafts, and food for the miners was grown in the valley. Although the valley's rainfall is low at 13 inches per year, the settlers in the 1860s already began overcoming that disadvantage by building small irrigation ditches fed by streams draining the snow-capped Bitterroot Mountains on the valley's west side, and later by engineering two sets of large-scale and expensive irrigation systems. Among other things, irrigation permitted a boom in apple orchards that began in the 1880s and peaked in the early decades of this century. But today, few of those orchards remain in commercial operation. Montana's environmental problems today include almost all of the dozen types of problems that have undermined pre-industrial societies in the past. Particularly conspicuous in Montana are problems of toxic wastes, forests, soils, water, and sometimes air, climate change, biodiversity losses, and introduced pests. Let's begin with seemingly the most transparent problem, that of toxic wastes. While concern is mounting in Montana about runoff of fertilizer, manure, septic tanks, and herbicides, by far the biggest toxic waste issue is posed by residues from metal mining, some of it from the last century, and some of it recent or ongoing. No one disagrees that mining is essential somewhere and somehow. Modern civilization and its chemical, construction, electric, and electronic industries run on metals. The question is, where and how best to mine metal-bearing ores? Unfortunately, the ore concentrate that is eventually carried away from a Montana mine represents only a fraction of the earth that must first be dug up. The remainder are waste rock and tailings still containing copper, arsenic, cadmium, and zinc, which are toxic to people, as well as to fish, wildlife, and livestock, and hence are bad news when they get into groundwater, rivers, and soil. In addition, Montana ores are rich in iron sulfide, which yields sulfuric acid. In Montana, there are about 20,000 abandoned mines, some of them recent, but many of them a century or more old, that will be leaking acid and those toxic metals, essentially, forever. In Montana, as elsewhere, companies that have acquired older mines respond to demands to pay for cleanup in either of two ways. Especially if the company is small, its owners may declare the company bankrupt, in some cases conceal its assets, and transfer their business efforts to new companies. If the company is so large that it cannot claim bankruptcy, it instead denies responsibility, or else seeks to minimize the costs. In either case, either the mine site and areas downstream of it remain toxic, thereby endangering people, or else taxpayers pay for the cleanup through the federal superfund and a corresponding Montana state fund. It is easy for us non-miners to become indignant at mining companies and to view their behavior as morally culpable. In fact, the moral issue is more complex. It's a cruel fact that no simple cheap way exists to clean up old mines. Early miners behaved as they did because the government required almost nothing of them. Not until 1971 did the state of Montana pass a law requiring mining companies to clean up their property when their mine closed. Even rich companies that may be inclined to clean up become reluctant to do so when they realize that they may then be asked to do the impossible, or that the costs will be excessive, or that the achievable results will be less than the public expected. When the mine owner can't or won't pay, taxpayers don't want to step in and pay billions of dollars of cleanup costs either. Most taxpayers balk at spending money if there isn't an immediate crisis, and not enough taxpayers complain about toxic waste or support high taxes. In this sense, we the public bear the ultimate responsibility. Only when the public pressures its politicians into passing laws demanding different behavior from mining companies will the companies behave differently. A second set of environmental problems in Montana involves the logging and burning of its forests. Just as no one denies that metal mining is essential, somewhere and somehow no one would dispute that logging is also necessary. The question that my Montana friends sympathetic to logging raise is, if you object to logging in Montana, where do you propose to get wood instead? The post-World War II housing boom in the U.S. caused timber sales on U.S. national forest land to peak around 1972 at over 6 times their 1945 levels. In order to be able to re-establish uniform, even-age trees of chosen tree species, and thereby to maximize timber yields and increase logging efficiency, logging was carried out by clear-cutting all trees rather than by selective logging of marked individual trees. Set against the big advantages of clear-cutting were some disadvantages. Water temperatures in streams no longer shaded by trees rose above values optimal for fish spawning and survival. Snow on unshaded bare ground melted in a quick pulse in the spring, instead of gradually melting and releasing water for irrigating throughout the summer. And in some cases, sediment runoff increased and water quality decreased. But the most visible evil of clear-cutting for citizens of a state who considered their land's most valuable resource to be its beauty was that clear-cut hillsides looked ugly, really ugly. The resulting debate became known as the clear-cut controversy. Outraged Montana ranchers, landowners, and the general public protested. U.S. Forest Service managers made the mistake of insisting that they were the professionals who knew all about logging, and that the public was ignorant and should keep quiet. The 1970 Bull Report, prepared by forestry professionals outside the Forest Service, criticized Forest Service policies, and, fanned by similar disputes over clear-cutting of West Virginia national forests, led to national changes, including restrictions on clear-cutting and a return to emphasis on managing forests for multiple purposes other than timber production. In the decades since, Forest Service annual timber sales have decreased by more than 80%, in part because of environmental regulations mandated in the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, and requirements for national forests to maintain habitats for all species, and in part because of the decline in easily accessible big trees due to logging itself. When the Forest Service now proposes a timber sale, environmental organizations file protests and appeals that take up to 10 years to resolve, and then make logging less economic, even if the appeals are ultimately denied. All of the Bitterroot Valley's former timber mills have now closed, because so little timber is available from Montana publicly owned timberland, and because the valley's privately owned timberland has already been logged twice. The mill's closing has meant the loss of many high-paying unionized jobs. Related to these issues of logging are issues of forest fires, which have recently increased in intensity and extent in some forest types in Montana and throughout the western U.S. This recent increase in fires has resulted partly from climate change and partly from human activities. One factor is the direct effects of logging. The ground in a logged forest may remain covered with lopped-off branches and treetops. A dense growth of new vegetation springs up, further increasing the forest fuel loads. And the trees logged and removed are, of course, the biggest and most fire-resistant individuals, leaving behind smaller and more flammable trees. Another factor is that the U.S. Forest Service in the first decade of the 1900s adopted a policy of fire suppression. The Forest Service's announced goal became, put out every forest fire by 10 a.m. on the morning after the day when it is first reported. Firefighters became much more successful at achieving that goal after World War II, thanks to improved firefighting technology. For a few decades after World War II, the annual acreage burnt decreased by 80%. That happy situation began to change in the 1980s due to the increasing frequency of large forest fires that were essentially impossible to extinguish unless rain and low winds combined to help. People began to realize that the U.S. federal government's fire suppression policy was contributing to those big fires, and that natural fires caused by lightning had previously played an important role in maintaining forest structure. That natural role of fire varies with altitude, tree species, and forest type. To take the Bitterroot's low-altitude ponderosa pine forest as an example, historical records, plus counts of annual tree rings and datable fire scars on tree stumps, demonstrated that a ponderosa pine forest experiences a lightning-lit fire about once a decade under natural conditions. The mature ponderosa trees have bark 2 inches thick, and are relatively resistant to fire, which instead burns out the understory of fire-sensitive Douglas fir seedlings that have grown up since the last fire. As a result, many natural ponderosa pine forests have a park-like appearance, with low fuel loads, big trees well spaced apart, and a relatively clear understory. Of course, though, loggers concentrated on removing those fire-resistant ponderosa pines, while fire suppression let the understory fill up with Douglas fir saplings that would in turn become valuable when full-grown. Tree densities increase from 30 to 200 trees per acre. The forest's fuel load increased by a factor of 6, and Congress repeatedly failed to appropriate money to thin out the saplings. When a fire finally does start in a sapling-choked forest, whether due to lightning or human carelessness or arson, the dense, tall saplings may become a ladder that allows the fire to jump into the crowns. The outcome is sometimes an unstoppable inferno, in which flames shoot 400 feet into the air, leap from crown to crown across wide gaps, reach temperatures of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, kill the tree's seed bank in the soil, and may be followed by mudslides and mass erosion. Foresters now identify the biggest problem in managing western forests as what to do with those increased fuel loads that build up during the previous half-century of effective fire suppression. In an ideal world, the Forest Service would thin them out and remove the dense understory by cutting or by controlled small fires, but that would cost over $1,000 per acre for a total of about $100 billion. No politician or voter wants to spend that kind of money. Even if the costs were lower, much of the public would be suspicious of such a proposal as just an excuse for resuming logging of their beautiful forest. Instead of a regular program of expenditures for maintaining our western forests in a less fire-susceptible condition, the federal government tolerates flammable forests and is forced to spend money unpredictably whenever a firefighting emergency arises. Montanans themselves hold diverse and often self-contradictory views about forest management and forest fires. On the one hand, the public fears and instinctively dislikes the let-it-burn response that the Forest Service is forced to take towards huge fires that would be dangerous or impossible to try to extinguish. When the 1988 fires and much of Yellowstone National Park were allowed to burn, the public was especially loud in its protests, not understanding that in fact there was nothing that could be done except to pray for rain or snow. On the other hand, the public also dislikes proposals for forest thinning programs that could make the forest less flammable. Because people prefer beautiful views of dense forests, they want to leave the forest in a natural condition, and they certainly don't want to pay for thinning by increased taxes. They fail to understand that western forests are already in a highly unnatural condition. The next set of environmental problems in Montana involves its soils. One minor and specific soil problem is that the Bitterroot Valley's boom in commercial apple orchards, which were initially very profitable, collapsed due in part to apple trees exhausting the soil's nitrogen. A more widespread soil problem is erosion, resulting from overgrazing, noxious weed infestation, logging, or excessively hot forest fires that sterilize the topsoil. The net result of these various causes is that about one-third of the Bitterroot's watersheds are considered to be in good shape, one-third are at risk of erosion, and one-third are already eroded and in need of restoration. The remaining soil problem in Montana is salinization, a process involving salt accumulation in soil and groundwater. While such accumulation has always occurred naturally in some areas, a more recent concern is the ruining of large areas of farmland by salinization resulting from some human agricultural practices, particularly from clearing of natural vegetation and from irrigation. In parts of Montana, salt concentrations in soil water have reached levels double those of seawater. Salinization is a problem today in many parts of the world besides the U.S. In the past, it contributed to the decline of the world's oldest civilizations. Salinization provides a large part of the explanation why applying the term Fertile Crescent today to Iraq and Syria, formerly the leading center of world agriculture, would be a cruel joke. Montana's main form of salinization is called saline seep. because salty water building up in the ground in an uphill area percolates through the soil to emerge as a seep in a downhill area up to half a mile or farther distant. Here is how a saline seep arises. Eastern Montana has lots of water-soluble salts present as components of the rocks and soils themselves, and also trapped in marine deposits, because much of the region used to be ocean. In dry eastern Montana environments covered with native vegetation, almost all rain that falls is promptly taken up by the vegetation's roots. However, when a farmer clears the native vegetation to practice crop and fallow agriculture, in which an annual crop is grown during one year and the land is left fallow the next year, there are no plant roots to take up rainwater in the fallow year. That rainwater accumulates in the soil, waterlogs it below the root layer, and dissolves salts that then rise into the root zone as the water table rises. Because of the impermeable underlying bedrock, the salty water doesn't drain deeply into the ground, but emerges somewhere downhill nearby as a saline seep. The result is that crops grow more poorly, or not at all, both in the uphill area where the problem arises and in the downhill area where the seep emerges. To start to understand the apparently intractable water problems that bedevil Montana, think of the Bitterroot Valley as having two largely separate water supplies: irrigation water from ditches fed by streams, lakes, or the Bitterroot River, and wells drilled into underground aquifers, which provide most of the water for domestic use. Both the irrigation water supply and the well water supply are facing the same fundamental dilemma: increasing numbers of users for decreasing amounts of water. The ultimate reason for decreasing amounts of water is climate change. Montana is becoming warmer and drier. While global warming will produce winners as well as losers in different places around the world, Montana will be among the big losers because its rainfall was already marginally adequate for agriculture. The most visible effect of global warming in Montana, and perhaps anywhere in the world, is in Glacier National Park. While glaciers all over the world are in retreat, the phenomenon has been especially well studied in Montana, because its glaciers are so accessible to climatologists. When the area of Glacier National Park was first visited by naturalists in the late 1800s, it contained over 150 glaciers. Now, there are only about 35 left, mostly at just a small fraction of their first reported size. At present rates of melting, Glacier National Park will have no glaciers at all by the year 2030. Such declines in the mountain snowpack are bad for irrigation systems, whose summer water comes from melting of the snow that remains up in the mountains. Agriculture would be impossible in the Bitterroot Valley without irrigation, because annual rainfall in the valley bottom is only about 13 inches per year. Construction of irrigation systems fed by snowmelt water began in the late 1800s and peaked in 1908 to 1910. Within each irrigation system or district, each landowner or group of landowners has the right to take a specified quantity of water from the system. Unfortunately, in most Bitterroot irrigation districts, the water is over-allocated. That is, the sum of the water rights allocated exceeds the flow of water available in most years. The solution is to assign priorities among landowners according to the historical date on which the water right was claimed for that property, and to cut off water deliveries first to the most junior right owner. That's a recipe for conflict, because the oldest farms with the earliest rights claimed are often downhill, and it's hard for uphill farmers with lower-ranking rights to see water that they desperately need flowing past their property, and yet to refrain from taking the water. But if they did take it, the downhill neighbors could sue them. A further problem results from land subdivision. Originally, the land was owned in large blocks, whose single owner, of course, wouldn't have been so silly as to try to water all his fields simultaneously and thus run out of water. But those original 160-acre blocks have become subdivided into 4-acre house lots. Each of those 40 house owners tries to water and keep the house's garden green without realizing that the other 39 neighbors are irrigating simultaneously. The Bitterroot's other water supply consists of wells for domestic water use, tapping into underground aquifers. They too face the problem of increasing demand for decreasing water. The Bitterroot's ongoing population explosion means more people drinking more water and flushing more toilets. Montana law and county regulations about domestic water are currently weak. The well that one new house owner drills may lower the water level of a neighbor's well, but it is difficult for the latter person to collect damages. In order to calculate how much domestic water use an aquifer could support, one would have to map the aquifer and to measure how rapidly water is flowing into it. But those two elementary steps have not been accomplished for any Bitterroot Valley aquifer. The county itself lacks the resources and does not carry out independent assessments of water availability when it is considering a developer's application to build a new house. Instead, the county relies on the developer's assurance that enough well water will be available for the house. Everything that I have said about water so far concerns water quantity. However, there are also issues of water quality. The Bitterroot River is already on Montana's list of impaired streams for several reasons. The most important of those reasons is buildup of sediments released by erosion, road construction, forest fires, logging, and falling water levels in ditches and streams due to use for irrigation. Air quality also deserves brief mention. Some areas of Montana suffer seasonally from poor air quality. Worst of all in Missoula, whose air is sometimes as bad as in Los Angeles. Missoula's air problems stem from a combination of vehicle emissions throughout the year, wood-burning stoves in the winter, and forest fires and logging in the summer. Montana's remaining major sets of environmental problems are the linked ones of introductions of harmful non-native species and losses of valuable native species. Montana originally supported valuable fisheries based on native cutthroat trout, the state fish, bull trout, Arctic grayling, and whitefish. All of those species except whitefish have now declined in Montana from a combination of causes: less water in the mountain streams where they spawn and develop, warmer temperatures and more sediment in those streams, overfishing, competition from, and in some cases, hybridization with, introduced rainbow trout, brook trout, and brown trout, predation by introduced northern pike and lake trout, and infection by an introduced parasite causing a disease called whirling disease. Whirling disease was accidentally introduced into the U.S. in 1958. It has now spread throughout most of the western U.S., partly through transport by birds, but especially as a result of people stocking lakes and rivers with infected fish. Once the parasite gets into a body of water, it is impossible to eradicate. By 1994, whirling disease had reduced the rainbow trout population of Montana's most famous trout stream by more than 90%. Another introduced disease, chronic wasting disease, is of more concern because it might cause an incurably fatal human illness. CWD is the deer elk equivalent of prion diseases in other animals, of which the most notorious are Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans and mad cow disease or bovine spongiform encephalopathy in cattle. These infections cause an untreatable degeneration of the nervous system. No human infected with Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease has ever recovered. CWD was first detected in western North American deer and elk in the 1970s. We do not know yet whether CWD can be transmitted from deer or elk to people, as can mad cow disease, but the recent deaths of some elk hunters from Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease have raised alarms in some quarters. While CWD is potentially Montana's most frightening problem caused by an introduced pest, introduced weeds are their most expensive. About 30 noxious weed species, mostly of Eurasian origin, have become established in Montana after arriving accidentally in hay or as windblown seeds, or in one case, being introduced intentionally as an attractive ornamental plant whose dangers weren't anticipated. They cause damage in several ways. They are inedible or poorly edible to livestock and wild animals, but they crowd out edible plant species, so they reduce the amount of livestock fodder by up to 90%. Some of them are toxic to animals, and they may triple rates of erosion because their roots hold the soil less well than do roots of native grasses. Economically, the two most important of these weeds are spotted knapweed and leafy spurge, both now widespread throughout Montana. Spotted knapweed takes over from native grasses by secreting chemicals that quickly kill them and by producing vast numbers of seeds. It has now infested 566,000 acres in the Bitterroot Valley alone and 5 million acres in all of Montana. Spotted knapweed can be controlled by herbicides, but the herbicide is very expensive, $800 per gallon. Leafy spurge is less widespread than knapweed, but much harder to control and impossible to pull out by hand because it establishes underground roots 20 feet long. Estimates of the direct economic damage that these and other weeds cause in Montana are over $100 million per year. Thus, seemingly pristine Montana actually suffers from serious environmental problems involving toxic wastes, forests, soils, water, climate change, biodiversity losses, and introduced pests. All of these problems translate into economic problems. They provide much of the explanation for why Montana's economy has been declining in recent decades to the point where what was formerly one of our richest states is now one of the poorest. Whether or how these problems become resolved will depend on the attitudes and values that Montanans hold. But Montana's population is becoming increasingly heterogeneous and cannot agree on a vision for their state's environment and future. They want more or less population growth, more or less government regulation, more or less development, more or less retention of agricultural uses of land, more or less mining, and more or less outdoor-based tourism. Some of these goals are obviously incompatible with others. Montana is experiencing many environmental problems that translate into economic problems. At present, there is honest and wide difference of opinion about the best approaches to solving those problems. We don't know which approaches the citizens of Montana will ultimately choose, and we don't know whether Montana's environmental and economic problems will get better or worse. It may initially have seemed absurd to select Montana as the first subject of a book on societal collapses. Neither Montana in particular, nor the U.S. in general, is in imminent danger of collapse. But please reflect that half of the income of Montana residents consists of money flowing into Montana from other U.S. states. Federal government transfer payments such as Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and poverty programs, and private out-of-state funds, out-of-state pensions, earnings on real estate equity, and business income. That is, Montana's own economy already falls far short of supporting the Montana lifestyle. If Montana were an isolated island, its present first-world economy would already have collapsed, nor could it have developed that economy in the first place. Then reflect that Montana's environmental problems we have been discussing, although serious, are much less severe than those in most of the rest of the U.S., almost all of which has much denser human populations and heavier human impacts, and much of which is environmentally more fragile than Montana. The U.S. in turn depends for essential resources on and is economically, politically, and militarily involved with other parts of the world, some of which have even more severe environmental problems and are in much steeper decline than is the U.S. No other site that I have visited made such a ghostly impression on me as Ranu Raraku, the quarry on Easter Island where its famous gigantic stone statues were carved. To begin with, the island is the most remote habitable scrap of land in the world. The nearest lands are the coast of Chile, 2,300 miles to the east, and Polynesia's Pitcairn Island, 1,300 miles to the west. When I arrived by jet from Chile, my flight took more than 5 hours, all spent over the Pacific Ocean, stretching endlessly between the horizons. Ranu Raraku is an approximately circular volcanic crater, about 600 yards in diameter, which I entered by a trail rising steeply up to the crater rim from the low plain outside, and then dropping steeply down again toward the marshy lake on the crater floor. Scattered over both the crater's outer and inner walls are 397 stone statues, representing in a stylized way a long-eared, legless human male torso, mostly 15 to 20 feet tall, but the largest of them 70 feet tall, and weighing from 10 up to 270 tons. The remains of a transport road can be discerned passing out of the crater through a notch cut into a low point in its rim, from which three more transport roads about 25 feet wide radiate north, south, and west for up to 9 miles toward Easter's coasts. Scattered along the roads are 97 more statues, as if abandoned in transport from the quarry. Along the coast, and occasionally inland, are about 300 stone platforms, a third of them formerly supporting, or associated with, 393 more statues, all of which, until a few decades ago, were not erect, but thrown down, many of them toppled so as to break them deliberately at the neck. From the crater rim, I could see the nearest and largest platform, called Ahu Tongariki, whose 15 toppled statues were re-erected in 1994 by means of a crane capable of lifting 55 tons. Even with that modern machinery, the task proved challenging, because the largest statue weighed 88 tons. Yet Easter Island's prehistoric Polynesian population had owned no cranes, no wheels, no machines, no metal tools, no draft animals, and no means other than human muscle power to transport and raise the statues. The statues remaining at the quarry are in all stages of completion. Some are still attached to the bedrock out of which they were being carved. Others are finished, detached, and lying on the crater slopes. The ghostly impression that the quarry made on me came from my sense of being in a factory whose workers had suddenly thrown down their tools and stomped out. Littering the ground at the quarry are the stoned picks, drills, and hammers with which the statues were being carved. Who carved the statues? Why did they carve them at such effort? How did the carvers transport and raise such huge stone masses? And why did they eventually throw them all down? Easter's many mysteries were already apparent to its European discoverer, the Dutch explorer Jacob Roggeveen, who spotted the island on Easter Day, April 5, 1722. As a sailor who had just spent 17 days crossing the Pacific from Chile in three large European ships without any sight of land, Roggeveen asked himself, how had the Polynesians greeting him reached such a remote island? The islanders' only watercraft were small and leaky canoes, no more than 10 feet long, capable of holding only one or two people. Like all subsequent visitors, Roggeveen was puzzled to understand how the islanders had erected their statues. To quote his journal, "We could not comprehend how it was possible that these people, who are devoid of heavy, thick timber for making any machines, as well as strong ropes, nevertheless had been able to erect such images, which were fully 30 feet high and thick in proportion." The Easter Island that he viewed was a wasteland with not a single tree or bush over 10 feet tall. The statue's sheer number and size suggest a population much larger than the estimated one of just a few thousand people encountered by European visitors in the 18th and early 19th centuries. What had happened to the former large population? Carving, transporting, and erecting statues would have called for many specialized workers. How were they all fed when the Easter Island seen by Roggeveen had no native land animals larger than insects and no domestic animals except chickens? All those mysteries have spawned volumes of speculation for almost three centuries. Many Europeans were incredulous that mere savages could have created the statues or the beautifully constructed stone platforms. The Norwegian explorer Thor Heyerdahl argued that Easter Island had instead been settled by advanced societies of South American Indians, who in turn must have received civilization across the Atlantic from the Old World. My own interest in Easter was kindled over 40 years ago by reading Heyerdahl's Kon-Tiki and his romantic interpretation of Easter's history. Going further, the Swiss writer Erich von Däniken claimed that Easter's statues were the work of intelligent spacelings who owned ultramodern tools, became stranded on Easter, and were finally rescued. The explanation that has now emerged attributes statue carving to stone picks rather than to hypothetical space implements, and to Easter's known Polynesian inhabitants rather than to Incas or Egyptians. This history is as romantic and exciting as postulated visits by Kon-Tiki rafts or extraterrestrials, and much more relevant to events in the modern world. Easter is a triangular island consisting entirely of three volcanoes that arose from the sea in close proximity to each other at different times within the last million or several million years, and that have been dormant throughout the island's history of human occupation. Easter's area of 66 square miles and its elevation of 1,670 feet are both modest by Polynesian standards. The island's topography is mostly gentle, without the deep valleys familiar to visitors to the Hawaiian Islands. The subtropical location gives Easter a mild climate, while its recent volcanic origins give it fertile soils. By themselves, this combination of blessings should have endowed the island with the makings of a miniature paradise, free from the problems besetting much of the rest of the world. Nevertheless, Easter's geography did pose several challenges to its human colonists. While a subtropical climate is warm by the standards of European and North American winters, it is cool by the standards of mostly tropical Polynesia. Hence, some tropical crops that are important elsewhere in Polynesia grow poorly on Easter, and the surrounding ocean is too cold for coral reefs that could rise to the surface and their associated fish and shellfish. Easter's isolation meant that it is deficient not just in coral reef fish, but in fish generally, of which it has only 127 species, compared to more than 1,000 fish species on Fiji. All of those geographic factors resulted in fewer food sources for Easter Islanders than for most of the other Pacific Islanders. The remaining problem associated with Easter's geography is its rainfall. On the average, only about 50 inches per year, low by Polynesian standards. The rain that does fall percolates quickly into Easter's porous volcanic soils. As a consequence, fresh water supplies are limited. Just one intermittent stream, ponds or marshes at the bottoms of three volcanic craters, wells dug down where the water table is near the surface, and fresh water springs bubbling up on the ocean bottom just offshore or between the high tide and low tide lines. Easter Islanders did succeed in getting enough water for drinking, cooking, and growing crops, but it took effort. Easter's crops were bananas, taro, sweet potato, sugarcane, and paper mulberry, typical Polynesian crops mostly of Southeast Asian origin. Easter's sole domestic animal, the chicken, was also typically Polynesian and ultimately Asian, as were the rats that arrived as stowaways in the canoes of the first settlers. The prehistoric Polynesian expansion was the most dramatic burst of overwater exploration in human prehistory. While Polynesians lacked compasses and writing and metal tools, they were masters of navigational arts and of sailing canoe technology. By around AD 1200, Polynesians had reached every habitable scrap of land in the vast watery triangle of ocean whose apexes are Hawaii, New Zealand, and Easter Island. Historians used to assume that all those Polynesian islands were discovered and settled by chance, as a result of canoes full of fishermen happening to get blown off course. It is now clear, however, that both the discoveries and the settlements were meticulously planned. Contrary to what one would expect for accidental drift voyages, much of Polynesia was settled in a west-to-east direction, opposite to that of the prevailing winds and currents. Transfers of many species of crops and livestock from taro to bananas and from pigs to dogs and chickens prove beyond question that settlement was by well-prepared colonists carrying products of their homelands deemed essential to the survival of the new colony. Easter Islanders themselves have a tradition that the leader of the expedition to settle their island was a chief named Hotumatua, the Great Parent, sailing in one or two large canoes with his wife, six sons, and extended family. Populations of many other Polynesian islands remained in contact with each other through regular inter-island voyaging after their initial discovery and settlement. Might that also have been true of Easter? Archaeologist Roger Green has suggested that possibility, on the basis of similarities between some Easter tool styles and the styles of Mongraven tools at a time several centuries after Easter's settlement. Against that possibility, however, stands Easter's traditional lack of dogs, pigs, and some typical Polynesian crops that one might have expected subsequent voyages to have brought. Thus, Easter Islanders may have remained effectively completely isolated for the 1,000 years or so separating Hotumatua's arrival from Roggeveen's. When was Easter occupied? There is considerable uncertainty about the date. What appear to be the most reliable dates for early occupation of Easter are the radiocarbon dates of AD 900, obtained on wood charcoal and on bones of porpoises eaten by people from the oldest archaeological layers offering evidence of human presence at Easter's Anacana Beach. These dates are likely to be close to the time of first settlement, because they came from layers containing bones of native land birds that were exterminated very quickly on Easter, and because canoes to hunt porpoises soon became unavailable. Hence, the current best estimate of Easter's settlement is somewhere before AD 900.